Welcome to get up close to the mic. You can probably hear me. Welcome to Buy Like Me. It's Phil Parr coming into your homes, into your places of business, or wherever you happen to be. Maybe your cars in some instances. However, with blind folks, maybe not so many cars. But wherever you're listening, we're glad to have you. And I'll let this next gentleman say a few words to you. Say hello and tell us where he's from. And then you tell me what his occupation is. All right? Go ahead, Ken.
Hi, my name is Ken Osborne. I'm from Birmingham, Alabama. I actually live in Irondale, which is east of Birmingham. And it's great to be on ACB Radio. I heard about the show just a few days ago, actually. And Phil and I talked, and the rest is history, and now we're doing the interview. And it's great to be on your show, Phil.
We're doing the interview. What would you figure that guy does for a living? What would you, just to hear his voice, what would you figure? Figure he's a doctor? Figure he's a broom salesman or change chairs or something. Ken, welcome to our show. Ken does radio production for a living. Is that correct?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I'm what's known as a freelance announcer. I do radio and television commercials for a living and also narrate slideshows and video presentations. As a matter of fact, I am tomorrow I will begin work. I also narrate guided tours. As of tomorrow, I will begin working on a script for the Tutwiler Hotel in Birmingham. It's a legendary hotel. It's been newly renovated, and I'm going to be doing the narrating the audio tour guide. People will have a chance to, I think, pick up receivers, if my understanding on it is correct. They will be able to collect a receiver at the front desk, and they'll be able to use that for their audio tour, and I'm going to begin working on that script as of tomorrow.
So wherever they go through that hotel, they'll be able to listen to your voice telling them about the amenities of the hotel and about the history and things like that. So you'll do that whole script for them. How long the script is this?
It is 32 pages in print. It looks like it would probably be approximately 60 pages in Braille.
Really?
So rather than try to write the whole thing up, I am going to prompt it. Audio prompted. I got my administrative assistant, Missy Lawrence, to read the print script on tape, and then I will put it to prompter tape, and using my voice as the prompt rather than hers, because her voice being of a different frequency would interfere.
Yeah.
And so using my voice as the initial prompt, I will then repeat after myself. And, in fact, I thought I had invented audio prompting. I was so proud of myself. But it turns out that they actually sell audio prompters. I think there's a place in Atlanta where you can buy them. A fellow named Dan Chandler makes them. Their audio prompters usually are used by on-camera talents. In some instances, they're hidden, and the on-camera person has the phone in their ear, and they listen to the prompters, and they're able to say a lot of stuff that is hard to say either with the cue cards or with the teleprompter. And so I'm able to this is not nearly as exhausting as trying to write up 60 pages of Braille.
In other words, you will have the script in your ear. They will be saying, today, this is part of the Atlanta Hotel, was built in 1860, and you just repeat that.
Uh-huh.
I have done 10,000 radio commercials using that very method. I don't do Braille, so that was my way of doing commercials. Somebody would write the copy, I would get them to read it. I used to carry a little battery-operated cassette machine, a little tiny, what they called a microcassette, in my pocket, and I would get someone to read the copy, and then I would go back and put a little earphone in my ear, and I would do it in my voice. That's the way I do commercials. That's because I don't read Braille, so... Anyway, that's the way you're going to do it. You're going to do what you call that audio prompting.
Uh-huh.
I've never had a name for it. That's good. All right, so you do anything audio that anyone wants done, commercials, slideshow presentations, whatever someone wants done in a in an announcer voice, that's what you do.
Uh-huh. I even read a book for a guy once.
Really?
A fellow in Europe wrote a book and wanted to get it on tape, and he and I got together via the Internet, and one thing led to another, and and I read his book for him.
Now, but that you obviously you did that audio prompting.
Uh huh.
That would have been a little lengthy to try to do in Braille.
In fact, that was the most lengthy project that I have ever done. In fact, I told my wife it took about 8 months for us to complete, and I said, I feel like I just had a baby here because all of a sudden a project going on for 8 months and all of a sudden I'm through. There's no more of it.
Yeah, I can see that. What length books was this? A couple hundred pages, I guess.
This was initially it started out as about an 800 page book, and they edited it down to about I think they've dropped it back to about 600. But when I read it, it was some 800 pages. The guy was it had 103 chapters in it, and this guy was very wordy, so he had a lot to say about everything that he talked about. So by the time we finished the book, it was a fictional thing. It was a mystery novel, and so it took a while to do.
The only thing that would bother me about that is, of course, when you come into the studio every day, you'd want to be on with the exact same level, the exact same distance from the mic, the exact amount of compression you used, if you used any. That would be hard to duplicate day-to-day, looks like.
That was one thing that made it easy for me. I didn't have to worry about compression because he compressed it all on his end, and I just recorded it and sent portions of it to him as I got it done.
Oh.
And then he would email me if I had made a mistake or misread something, and I would do that portion and send it to him. And keep on going with the book. And sometimes he would find mistakes that I had made after the fact. So it's about an 8 or 9 month project. And
I hope he paid you well, because that was a long, lengthy project.
Yeah, it was. But it was a pretty amazing book. The guy had an imagination, and so it was. I don't know if you'd call it riveting reading, but it was I'd never read anything quite like that before.
Now, I don't think we've asked you this. What is your level of vision, Ken?
Actually, I'm totally blind. As a matter of fact, now, I used to be able to see lights and shadows and a few colors, but as of this summer, for some unknown reason, I lost my light perception. So, and I didn't realize how much I took that for granted. I used to call it taffy vision because I did stretch it for everything it was worth.
Yeah.
But I lost that over the summer, and it was so slow, it was kind of like a frog in the kettle thing. I didn't realize it was happening until all of a sudden I got to realizing it one day when I realized that when I work and when I'm out in public, I wear dark glasses because my eyes did not develop properly.
Yeah.
So I wear dark glasses to keep from freaking people out. And one day I realized, hey, there's not a whole lot of difference between the light when I've got my dark glasses on and when I take them off. Is something going on here? And I, at first I thought, well, maybe it's the foyer, because our foyer is not well lighted. It's kind of dim in there.
Yeah.
But then I walked into another part of the house, and it was no different. So I went and got a flashlight out of my closet, and I shined it directly into my eye, and I turned it on.
Nothing.
And I felt the heat, but I just barely saw the light, and that's when I realized, son of a gun, I'm blind now.
Let's go back and start at, because your story is kind of unusual. The reason we do this show is to inspire the blind people who have lost their vision at some age and think, well, my God, what am I going to do now? How am I going to make it? What future do I have as a blind person? Your story is kind of unusual as a small child. Why don't we go back to when you were there, what they told you of when you were first born?
Actually, my mother didn't even know. For a little while, I might have been several hours old, possibly 2 to 3 days old by the time she finally found out that I was blind. She discovered it in a most unpleasant way. I was born in a what at the time was a little country hospital, and I was delivered by a simple country doctor who had never seen anybody quite like me before, and he didn't know how to tell my mother that she had given birth to a child who had no eyes, and so he didn't bring it up. And so my mother was playing with me and stuff, and she kept wanting me to open my eyes and look at her, but I wouldn't. Well, the first couple of times that she saw me, she cut me some slack because it had been a tough birth for both of us, and she figured I was just tired. And so about the third or fourth time we were together, she decided, well, if you're not going to open your eyes, I'm going to open them for you. So she pried one of my eyes open, and that's when she saw that the reason I hadn't opened my eyes and looked at her because there was nothing to look at her with.
There were no eyes. Yeah.
She was upset. Uh-huh. And she screamed, and the nurse came running, and she said, get the doctor. And the doctor knew what the matter was about, and he walked in, and he stared at the floor. And
yeah.
he just was at a loss of words, at a loss for words.
I'm sure that it did terrify her or scare her to realize that the child she'd given birth to had. Were you her first child?
No, actually, I was the middle child. They didn't plan to have any more children. My parents didn't because they were afraid that perhaps they might have another blind or another blind child or a child perhaps with a different kind of handicap.
Yeah.
And they didn't really intend to have another child, but they did about. Oh, some 5 years later, my little sister was born. And I was sandwiched in between two girls. And so, and then when I grew up and got married, I wound up having three daughters. So I've been surrounded, virtually surrounded by women all my life.
Well, there are worse things that happen to a guy, I suppose.
That's true.
Your younger sisters, and her eyes are all right?
Mm-hmm. In fact, both my sisters' vision was perfectly fine. And so... my parents were very relieved to find out that I was the only blind child in the family.
And you say you were delivered by an old country doctor. Where was this?
It was in Sylacauga, and I never did ask my mother the name of the hospital, but
Sylacauga, Illinois, or
Sylacauga, Alabama.
Sylacauga, Alabama.
And I was born in 1952.
That's one on me. Sylacauga, Alabama. All right, we're writing that down.
Well, Sylacauga, Illinois is new on me.
I thought there was a Sylacauga, Illinois. I thought I'd heard of one. So, but anyway, Sylacauga, Alabama. And what when you were a little boy, what did they decided it would, came 5 or 6 years old, it was time for a little Kenny to go to school. What thoughts did they have then?
Well, I wound up starting out at the time my parents. And we were all living in Tampa, Florida. In fact, we left Alabama when I was about 6 months old and moved to Tampa, Florida. And so I started out at Bayside School for the Blind, and it was literally, well, it was Bayside School, and it was for the blind and for other people with handicaps. We had people going there who had cerebral palsy and polio and various other disabilities. Some were multi-handicapped individuals, and it was literally by the bay. As a matter of fact, when the window was open, which was most of the time, because in Tampa, Florida, White Christmas sounded like a joke. It could be 85 degrees on Christmas Day, and so you could hear the boats and smell the salt air, and so that was not a very good place to go to school for a young man who was a daydreamer like me. And hearing those boats and smelling that salt air, I didn't like school. And so and they were kind of the philosophy that you could lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And I wasn't a horse. I was more of a donkey. So I just wasn't doing very well in school.
Yeah. Now this was a school for blind children.
Mm-hmm. They had plenty of Braille materials and they had the Braille writers and everything that a blind child would need. So it wasn't as if I was in a mainstream situation where I was out of place. I just didn't like school.
You didn't like it, and you like you said, they couldn't make you learn.
No, and they didn't try very hard. Sometimes they sent me to the, quote, other room, but the other room was full of toys, and so when I knew the teacher wasn't paying attention to me, I just found me something to play with. And so it just... and I was, I wasn't a bad kid, and so it was hard to, it was hard for them to be extremely hard on me because I wasn't, I didn't disrupt class or anything like that. I just simply didn't like school.
Well, and obviously you were intelligent enough to learn if you decided you wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things I liked. In fact, I when I was younger, I could memorize massive amounts of material. I at one time I had memorized basically all of the book Charlotte's Web, which was read by Alexander Scorby. I liked that book so much that I basically memorized it. I don't remember it now. There's very little of it that I can remember now. But at one point in my life, I had it memorized, and there are several short stories that are still in my head today that I have passed along. I passed along to my children when they were little. And I told them as a child. I shared them with my cousins, I did. My brain could absorb information. I just found most of the scholastic information boring and useless.
One of the things that you liked really about Charlotte's Web was that Alexander Scorby's voice.
Uh-huh. As a matter of fact, Alexander Scorby, though he and I never met, he has taught me more about reading and announcing and inflection and enunciation and all the things that an announcer needs to know. He's probably been my greatest teacher. Although, like I say, he and I never met. He was one of my favorite, all-time favorite readers, and I learned more from him probably than I have from anybody else.
Yeah, when you think about it, too. Of course, if Alexander Scorby had been called upon to do the commercial for the local Buick dealer that's having a sale, he would have done it in his voice. He would not have screamed it like they make us do today.
That's true, because everything that Alexander Scorby ever did was clearly Alexander Scorby. You know, I think for a while he did the Ford commercials, and it was like, Ford, where quality is job one. And he was the guy, you know, the Johnson & Johnson, Band-Aid shear strip. It's a dirty world, you know, and everything he did was just
was in his style.
Mm-hmm.
One of the little gospel, I live in kind of a Bible Belt area in East Texas, and we have four. We have two local radio stations in the educational band playing gospel music and trying to make me worship their God. And we have two little repeaters that come from different places. And on one of them, hourly, they let Alexander Scorby read a verse from the Bible. And while I may not agree with what he's reading, I love to hear him read it.
There's no question. Whatever he reads, he brings magic to it. In fact, I have. We have a station, WGIB, here in Birmingham, where he reads passages from the Bible every night, several chapters. And you can, if you listen every night devotedly, Monday through Friday, you can hear the Bible in about a year.
Yeah, he did a version of the Bible. I guess one could probably buy that at Christian Words and Works or some bookstore. Anyway, you obviously at a young age you fell in love with radio, with broadcasting, with the sound of radio. Am I right?
I fell in love with it at the age of 7. Oddly enough, it wasn't Alexander Scorby who made me fall in love with it. It was actually a cigarette commercial. Back in those days, there was a television show called Tales of Wells Fargo. Tales of Wells Fargo was sponsored by Pall Mall Famous Cigarettes. And there was an announcer who said, Pall Mall Famous Cigarettes, outstanding. And then this other guy would go, and they are mild.
Yes.
And when I heard that, I went, I want to do that sound. And I didn't know what you called it, but I just knew that I wanted to do it. And so my parents would put us to bed, and they would watch television, and that was before computer graphics and stuff put so much writing on the screen that announcers have become almost useless to a degree. Well, not quite. That's a harsh word.
But back then, they had booth announcers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the booth announcers a lot of times did the stuff live, and they didn't record the stuff, and they didn't use the computer graphics to flash words on the screen, and so the announcer was very much a part of television. And I heard Surfside 6, sponsored by, you know, and so it was another, it was a type of announcing boot camp. And my mother bought me records that just happened to have good narrators on them. So between the television announcing, hearing books read by Alexander Scorby, and getting records that just happened to have good narrators on them, God just worked it out so that I was learning my craft, and he did it so carefully, since and knowing me as he does, he knew at the time I didn't like school, so he just made it fun for me, and I was absorbing and learning all this and not even realizing that I was being taught for what would later be my career.
Your eventual career. What did you call it a while ago? You called it audio prompting. Did you do that with announcers back then?
No. Since I did get to learn Braille, I did. Back then as a child.
Yeah, when you heard a guy reading a commercial, did you mimic him as he read it?
No, I didn't even think about that. I would just
really.
I just listened and enjoyed them, and I enjoyed listening to the radio, and I thought that the people in radio were the most fortunate people alive, because back then the music was good, you could understand all the words, and it was just radio and between the music on the radio and the good announcers that they had back in those days, and television with high quality commercials with correct grammar. There was a lot of good listening back then.
Mine was Fatima. Best of all, long cigarettes brings you Dragnet. I just loved it. That somehow made, you know, I don't know what is there about those things you hear announcers say. I didn't fall in love with radio because of that, but mine was a little different story. But anyway, you fell in love with announcing, not necessarily radio, but being an announcer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all right. Did you finish high school at this school for the blind, or what did they do with you as you got older?
No, my mother began to realize that things that I wasn't really learning as much as I should. She got the idea, as I said earlier, I was able to memorize massive amounts of material, and I heard other students reading during the day, and I kind of memorized what they were supposed to be reading, and because it was my reading lesson at night. And so mother's intuition kicked in, and she realized that perhaps I wasn't reading the book quite like I needed to. Maybe my fingers didn't do as much. Maybe my fingers didn't go along the page as much as my mouth talked. I don't know.
Maybe you were memorizing. She figured you out.
Yep, she did. As a matter of fact, she went to Bayside and got some Braille material that I had never seen before. And so when reading time came, she plopped it down in front of me, and I could not read it very well. And that's when she told my dad, she said, he's memorizing his books. We've got to do something. So they sent me to the Florida School for the Blind in St. Augustine, which at that time was about 6 hours away. In fact, it was so far away from Tampa that we had a carpool. There were several kids with several parents with children in St. Augustine, so they used to take turns picking us up and taking us back. And I only got to go home every 2 weeks, and this was a drastic change for me.
Well, it was. How old were you when this happened?
I was 10.
Yeah.
And it was a drastic change. I didn't like it. I was kind of behind in school because of my lack of interest in education by that time. And so the principal didn't really pay attention to where I needed to go, and he sent me to the wrong grade. And so for about 2 weeks, I sat in the wrong grade in St. Augustine, just messing around again.
A lower grade, a grade you'd already been through, or what?
That actually sent me to a higher grade.
Oh, really?
They sent me to what should have been my appropriate grade.
And there was no way you could keep up?
No. And the teacher, I probably could have had I applied myself, but when I told the teacher what grade I was in, and he realized, you know, that Mr. Davis, the principal, had just sent me to the wrong room. Apparently, this Mr. Davis's absent-mindedness was something that he'd had to put up with for quite a while, and so he just let it slide for a couple of weeks. And then he finally thought, you know, I'm really not doing this kid right.
Yeah.
He sent me to the right room, and so I began to apply myself, and things began to roll along, and all of a sudden, my dad got laid off from his job in Florida, and he had heard about the Alabama School for the Blind in Talladega, and he knew that if he got work in Birmingham, it wouldn't be any 4 to 6 hour drive from Tampa to St. Augustine. By the way, they put in the freeway since then, and it's not that long now. It's like down to about 2.5 hours.
Yeah, it wouldn't be nearly that long now, but back then it was two-lane roads.
Yeah, and it was a long, arduous trip.
Yeah.
And so he decided, well, you know, I got laid off from my job. We're going to Alabama. And so I came home from St. Augustine that Friday night, and my parents said, well, we're going to Alabama tomorrow. And that was another shock, because all of a sudden I was uprooted again, hadn't spent that long in St. Augustine. I was uprooted again and sent to Alabama. But the folks in Alabama they listened, and I wound up with a teacher who, when she saw that I wasn't interested, took me aside, talked to me, found out how to make me interested, long story short. And so I began to really apply myself from then on, and I did it for her, out of love for her. Still didn't like school, but I loved her.
And you began actually reading Braille and actually absorbing some of the material.
Mm-hmm.
Graduated from Alabama School for the Blind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
spent 2 years at Gadsden State Junior College, and finally got my first job in radio.
All right, let's get into that in just a minute. When we take take a short break, and be back in a minute with more of our show called Blind Like Me. Ken Osborne is our guest, and we'll continue in just a minute.
Should have the same information concerning United States currency as their sighted brethren.
Now, if you think this is a great idea, thanks to the American Council of the Blind, there is something you can do.
You'll find a screen reader friendly site and an online petition waiting for you at www.moneyforall.info.
That's www.moneyforall.info.
Come be a part of history with the American Council of the Blind. www.moneyforall.info.
All right, we are back. Ken Osborne is our guest. From near Birmingham, Alabama, makes his living as an announcer. Does anything that requires voice, slideshows, movie trailers, car commercials, anything that requires a live voice or a personal voice, anything they can't synthesize, they call Ken. All right, Ken, we have you finishing high school at the Alabama School for the Blind.
Mm-hmm.
And actually enjoying it, having a good time. Then you went off to college. What did you think you could do as a blind person to make yourself a living? You wanted to do radio.
Well, by that time, actually I have to backtrack just a little bit, because shortly after I came to the School for the Blind, I met in the early part of 1963, I met my wife, met the girl who is now my wife, Charlotte. And the amazing thing about that was that when she and I first met, we didn't like each other at all.
Uh-huh.
And if anybody had told us that we would grow up and marry each other later, we would have said, yeah, we're going to grow up and get married, but we are definitely not marrying each other. We would never have believed it. But So by the time I got out of high school, Charlotte and I were very much in love. We started dating in 1969, and she graduated from high school in 1971. She graduated with every honor that the school at that time could give her, and I graduated in 1972, and I tell people, and it's all too true, my wife graduated with honors, and it was an honor that I graduated. But I did, inspired by my love for Charlotte and my love of radio. I had learned about a fellow named Dr. Tom Benham of Vallakenwood, Pennsylvania, Science of the Blind, and he invented Braille meter readers. And so I was sure that if I could read my own meters, that I could get into radio. And so yeah. I began my quest to get into radio. After graduating from the Alabama School for the Blind, I went to Gadsden State Junior College.
And what did you study there? Did they have a radio department?
Yes, they did. At the time, they did not have a radio station, but they had the broadcast instructor. We learned broadcast history. We learned broadcasting and government. We learned announcing techniques, and we even had what back then was a broadcasting lab, which was two turntables and some records and a tape recorder so that we could play disc jockey and then listen to ourselves.
And some sort of a mixing board to mix all that through.
Mm-hmm. And so my happiest hours at Gadsden State were when I was in broadcasting lab.
Because that was your first... The first actual hands-on stuff that you had done with radio.
Uh-huh.
And you actually got to play records and intro records and cue records and turn the mic off and on. Do they have a cart machine or not?
Yes, we did have cart machines.
So you actually got to really play disc jockey.
Mm-hmm. We did. We very much got to literally play disc jockey. We got to make commercials. As a part of our broadcasting curriculum, and our final, I'd forgotten this until I just now got to thinking about it. But as one of our finals, we got together with anybody we wanted to. We formed we did in groups of twos and threes, depending on how many people we needed. We got together and did a documentary, and I partnered with a fellow named Cal Orvette, who was also in broadcasting at the time, and we did a documentary on America and the fuel shortage.
Really?
I graduated in 1974, and by then we were in the throes of that very thing, if memory serves me correctly.
This was during Watergate and during, I think Richard Nixon resigned in August of 74, so yes, we had made someone mad over there, and they quit selling us oil.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember who, but so this was actually this little college stint that you did was a good thing for you, wasn't it?
It gave me a chance to know what the inside of a radio station was really like, at least to a degree, and it also gave me a sneak preview of what I might encounter when I got out into the job market and began looking for a job. As a matter of fact, my broadcast professor Don Smith, who was very instrumental in my success. He said, when he found out that a blind person was coming to his class, he said, yeah, I'll teach him, but nobody's going to want to hire him. But now, if he wants to study broadcasting, that's fine with me. and Don was very upfront and very honest, and he never let me get too high on myself. I asked him one day, I said, by the way, Don, how am I doing exactly? And he said, well, you're keeping up with the other guys. And I said, that's wonderful. And he said, well, you don't know the other guys. So... He made sure that I didn't get too overconfident. The only way in which he cut me a little bit of slack one time, it was almost I really shouldn't have done him this way, because back then I was perfectly capable of typing. We had a speech class as part of our broadcast curriculum, and so I did my speech outline in Braille, and I held it up for him to see, and he said, Ken, lovely, what is it? And I said, it's my speech outline. And then I read it to him. He said, okay. But I think I would have done better to have written it up for him, to have typed it up for him.
But you got your point across. But, you know, you said that no one would be, they will teach him broadcasting, but no one's going to want to hire him. I would like to go back and look at that class, and I'll bet you that if there are any other people in broadcasting still, I would be amazed. You're probably the only one who actually was able to parlay it into actual money.
Well, there was me and another gentleman named Bob Lockamy, who wound up in Birmingham Radio, and one of the nicest guys in the business. And so he was in broadcasting in Birmingham Radio until about 2 or 3 years ago. I don't know where he is now, but I'm sure that he's somewhere, you know, doing something.
Maybe he's had sense enough to get a real job. I hope. I hope so. What? So you got your little certificate from this 2-year junior college, and you sallied forth into the world to look for that first job. Tell us some of the. I'm sure you went to several stations before someone hired you. Tell us about that experience.
Well, I would. My first big experience, what should have been a real indication of what I was going to be up against, came toward the end of my college career in the early part of 1974. The Alabama Broadcasters Convention saw fit to hold their annual meeting in Gadsden, the very place where my broadcasting school was. So I thought this was destiny.
Yeah.
I thought, well, now this is. This is too good, you know. The convention is here. The broadcasters are going to be here. I've got a demo tape ready, which back then, when you do it for radio, they call it an air check. I got my air check ready. I am armed. I mean, I took that tape everywhere I went, so that if I ran into some big executive, I'd be able to, you know, play it for him right away. Hmm. And so, my dream radio station was WSGN. Back in those days, it was a wonderful place to work. They had the best DJs. They played the best music. And it was an absolutely terrific radio station.
Now, this was an AM or an FM?
It was AM, AM 610.
610.
Uh-huh. As a matter of fact, it was one of those AM stations that was going, you know, before there was FM, and I think... Yeah. The FM was really starting to come into its own in the 1970s.
That's correct.
I remember in the late 60s, we got our WCRT, which was around, in fact, it may be what has become 96.5 at this point, but back then it was Birmingham's only FM stereo station, and it was an easy listening.
And they played easy listening music all the time, because that's what FM stations did back then.
Uh-huh.
That's what they were good for.
But in 1974, we'd taken a break from the convention meetings, and I got up from the table. We had just had lunch, and I got up from the table, and this gentleman approached me. And he said, "Could I help you get somewhere? My name is Ben Kitchens. I'm the president of WSGN."
And you thought, "Oh, here we go."
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I'm surprised that I was able to even find my voice.
I am too.
Because I told somebody one time, I said, now I know how, I knew then how Moses must have felt when he stared into that burning bush. I mean, I thought, this is
Yeah, but how fortuitous, boy, could he help you get somewhere.
Uh-huh, because, you know, the president of my dream station. So I said, yes, as a matter of fact, I was wondering if you and I could go to room 103, where they're doing playbacks of air checks and stuff. And he said, yes. And so we went there together. We had to use the elevator. I don't think I needed it. I think it was for his benefit. got up there, and there was nobody in there except the technician. So they put my tape on and played my air check. And when it was over, it seemed like a long time before Mr. Kitchen spoke. And he said, "You're a very talented young man. Talk to my program director." Well, I didn't realize at the time, but this was, well, in all fairness to Mr. Kitchens, the really big radio stations, the executives did not interfere with the program directors and the people like that. They let them, you know, do their jobs.
At the good ones, they didn't. They let the program director do what he was supposed to do.
Right. And so he was really sending me to the right authority. But I think, too, he might have been relieved that he could do that at the time. I really can't say, because he was very kind, but that was the last thing he said. You're a very talented young man. Talk to my program director. Well, I went to see the program director, and the program director wasn't interested in hiring me at all, because they did things differently at WSGN from the way they did them at Gadsden State, and it didn't take him long to ask me about doing something that I couldn't figure out a way to do. So he said, well, we can't hire you because...
Do you remember what it was?
He said, you'd have an awful lot of music to keep up with, and we've got an awful lot of it on reel-to-reel tape. And I either had not heard that at that time of the Dymo tape labeler, or I was intimidated, I don't remember which, but I wasn't able to assure him that I... my wife said she didn't think I'd heard of it at the time, so I wasn't sure how I could put labels
on tapes.
Such a massive amount of tape. And so I couldn't answer him quickly and satisfactorily enough, and so he said, well, you know, we can't hire you because you'd be fooling with an awful lot of the tape, and we use cart machines for our commercials, and there'd be an awful lot of stuff that you'd have to be able to locate quickly and efficiently, and if you can't do that, then you wouldn't be able to work here.
And they probably their music was probably, if they were a decent radio station, the music was probably on cart. And you would have had to label every cart in the building, because like a record, you can play the first few seconds, and you know what it is. A cart, you can't do that. There's no way to re-cue it.
Now, that's true. And in fact, I would call a lot of radio stations. I'd call them to let them know I'm sending my air check, and they'd say, "Man, you got a terrific voice. We're looking forward to hearing your air check." And I would mention that I was blind, and then it would be like I'd thrown cold water in their face. Listen, we'll listen to your air check, and we'll let you know what we think.
Yeah.
And so I never heard back from most of them.
Finally,
it was a friend of a friend of a friend thing. This friend of Charlotte's just happened to have a sister who had a boyfriend who knew that there was about to be a vacancy in a small South Alabama radio station.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, what have I got to lose? So I called down there, and I happened to get in touch with a very young radio station owner, and he was curious about how in the world a blind man could do radio. And so instead of me having to go to his office, he had a friend who flew an airplane, and so they flew up to Gadsden to see Charlotte and me. And so rather than me sitting in the radio station trying to answer questions, I actually had him in my territory, and we were able to show him the magnetic labels on our canned goods, and by then we had heard of Dymo tape, so we had a few things Dymo labeled, and I showed him how I could label albums with that, and he knew that I convinced him that I had enough of a background in music so that I could recognize records easily, but I was hired on the condition that I would be able to do the news. And at that time, a man named Guy Carboneau had invented a Braille teletype system that turned the news into Braille as it came out over the wire. Well, long story short, that didn't quite work out, but my I was able to stay at WPRN in Butler, Alabama, because I have the God-given ability to write creative commercials. And so my commercial creativity, along with my skill as a DJ, helped me to keep the job, even though I didn't...
Even though your newscasting left something to be desired.
It really did. And
I imagine it did.
So... I never did do the news while I was in radio.
Yeah. Now, so you and Charlotte up and moved. You had married by then.
Charlotte and I married in 1972.
And so it was off
1972 while I was still at Gadsden State, and she worked at the Holy Name of Jesus Hospital in Gadsden as a medical transcriber.
And so it was off to Butler, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this? I think you told me the other day. Is this where the police? Is this that story?
Yes. It was such a small town that they didn't have a taxi service, and I had to be taken to and from work by the police. This led to a couple of interesting situations. We had moved from 306 Acres Drive to 612 Gibbons Boulevard, and there was one neighbor who knew us and knew our situation and that I had to use the police to get me back and forth. But the other neighbor who was talking to her at the time did not. And so when she saw the police car drive up with a blind man in it, she said, "Well, bless his heart, he must have wandered off and got lost." And so we, and another interesting situation that came out of that little deal was, I needed a haircut, so I called the police and got a policeman to come and get me and take me to the barber shop. And I found out later that the policeman was walking with me, and my insurance agent was walking behind us, and two old ladies were behind him, and they saw the policeman with me, and one of them said, "Well, what is he taking that poor old blind man to jail for?"
But now, this guy that owned the radio station was the mayor of the town, is that it? Didn't you tell me that?
He did later become the mayor of the town shortly after I began working for him.
Yeah, so you could get city officials to drive you around. But was this a town where you could walk to places? I mean, you couldn't walk to work?
No, at the time it was too far away. Later on, the station moved down to Highway 10, which was much closer, and I could have walked to work, but the traffic was fast and treacherous, and when I tried to, I especially wanted to walk home from work. It was a source of pride for me.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the traffic was so bad, some of the small town people were gossiping about Daryl not taking care of me and taking me home. So
yeah.
In order to keep my boss's reputation intact, I had to give up walking home.
Okay, we've killed a good bit of time. However, do you realize that there are lots of blind folks out there who are in the same predicament you are in, they're graduating from high school to college and want to get in radio. And this is the way you do it, sighted, blind, or otherwise. You don't start out doing afternoons on the big rocker in town. I don't care who you are.
No.
You start out at some small station in Butler, Alabama, or a town like that. Where did you end up from Butler? Why did you leave, and where'd you go?
I went from Butler to Talladega, which is about 60 miles from Birmingham. I started working for an AM/FM operation. Got an opportunity, a job opening came available for me in June of 1978. So we moved from Butler, and I got the job in June of 1978, and I was working from AM/FM operation, and had a lot of. I worked there for approximately 6 years.
Were you on the air just doing production, or were you a disc jockey?
I was a DJ. I worked in production, and I eventually became music director at the radio station.
All right, and that was a good experience. Is that where the guy made you sign your when you finally left, he made you sign your last paycheck or something in Braille? What was that you told me the other day?
He made me sign when I gave him my resignation letter. He made me sign my name in print, and he also made me sign my name in Braille so that people could see that he didn't run me off.
That nobody would think he was terminating you. Why did you leave that job? What were they doing that did they? This guy wanted rid of you. Wanted you out for some reason.
No, he didn't treat me well. He was he resented the fact that by then I had started doing freelance announcing at night in Birmingham, and I was receiving calls from advertising agencies during the day at the station. And he felt like, you know, as you know, when you work in radio, doing commercials is part of your job. Whether you do five commercials or 50 in a day, that's just a part of your job.
Yeah, it's what you do.
But when you become a freelance announcer, you get paid for each and every commercial that you do. And so he was afraid that all this extra commercial money was going to interfere with my dedication to him. And if he had, and he didn't understand how much I really loved radio. If he had treated me just a little better, there's no telling how much longer I would have stayed. But it got to the point where he made it more difficult for me to receive calls during the day. He tried to cut off calls even to my listeners. And so one thing led to another, and I just decided that, and I got the opportunity to become a full-time freelance announcer because the people at Martin Advertising from whom I got my first big freelance break,
yeah.
gave me an opportunity to go full time, and I realized at that point that if I could really get on, I could do better, and wouldn't have nearly so much pressure to contend with. And so, as of July 1st of 1984. KO Productions was born.
So you've been doing this 23 years now.
Uh-huh.
Now, but you only worked at two radio stations, really.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, I only worked at four. However, it took me 40 years to do it because they kept firing me from different places I worked. Five. I worked at five, full-time at five different radio stations, which doesn't sound like much. I know guys that worked at 50, you know?
Oh, yeah, it's... that Harry Chapin song, I am
the morning, at W-O-L-D-D.
Yep, talks about the instability of radio.
Yeah.
And it is. In fact, it's hard on marriages. My wife has said more than once, because they grind you up like hamburger meat, and my wife has said more than once that if I were still in radio, we probably wouldn't be together at this point in our lives. In fact, she didn't realize, because I was in such a grinder all day, and she was being ground up herself as a homemaker with three little girls, twins and then a younger daughter. So we both were, trying to raise kids, and she was trying to raise kids, and I was trying to keep the wolf away from the door. And at one point, I was working two jobs, going in radio in the daytime and then freelancing at night. In fact, our youngest daughter didn't realize for a long time that I was actually her daddy. She thought I was some guy that mama let hang around on the weekends.
The milkman
or something.
We never saw
each other except on weekends.
Yeah, on the weekends you really wanted to be at the radio station because of all those things you could be doing while you were... I made a stupid mistake. I got into engineering, and so, like I told you, at one time I was chief engineer, program director, operations manager, and did mornings and so everything that happened was my fault. I mean, and getting into engineering, that took up my weekend, so, you know. But I loved every minute of it. I've lost my desire to be on the air now, but at one time that's all I wanted to do, and I'm sure you were absolutely the same way.
Well, thanks to consultants and bean counters, it's not fun anymore, but I still miss radio. I mean, I think it's stupid for DJs to have to say things like, more music, less talk. You have to talk to let people know you're not talking. And you also, we have, and it's probably the same way all over the country, because so many of these stations have become cookie-cutter stations since they've been bought up by these conglomerates. But we also have a situation where, you know, you have to be on and you have to promote the morning show. And I'd get in trouble in today's modern radio, because if I had to promote Rick and Bubba or John Bob and John Boy and Billy Bob, I'd say, you're listening to the chopped liver portion of the program,
yeah,
and so, which wouldn't go over very well. So I don't fit in today's radio environment.
John Boy and Billy are all things redneck. You know,
yeah.
that's all they are, things redneck.
Well, Rick and Bubba are pretty much all things redneck part two, so...
It's interesting. I've got a friend named Ken Heron. He and Ken and Beaner in Syracuse, New York. They were on in Birmingham and Syracuse. They were doing well in both markets. Just the radio station just didn't renew their contract. They're making $100,000 a year apiece. Just didn't renew the contract. So if you go a year without working, that kind of cuts that in half, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, and that's kind of hard. And radio is so so unstable, you know, and freelance announcing is pretty much the same way. You know, in the good times, you have to save your money for the bad.
And, I really just met you a week or so ago, and I met you because your wife Charlotte joined our Blind Like Me list. But since I've talked to you, we've scheduled this interview two or three times, and you've had to cancel because you got a job. So obviously, you're getting a good many calls.
Yeah, the business, the year got off to a lousy start, but business is picking up, and we can definitely see the momentum changing. It's getting busier and busier.
Well, of course, January and February are a bad time for everything. You know, radio stations slow down, give away commercials, and but you're doing all right, and actually able to. Is Charlotte still doing medical transcription or not?
No, actually, Charlotte works with me now. In fact, computers and I don't get along very well, so one of the smartest things I did was to have married her back in 1972 and been lucky enough to have held on to her, because she loves computers. I hate computers almost as much as she loves them. So She does the computer work that's done. I do my commercials. We've got a client out in Dallas, Texas, for example, the McCarthy Companies that we work for, and they work strictly via email. And I record what they want my recorder downstairs, and then I call my wife, and she answers the phone upstairs in the computer room, and she queues up SoundForge 6.0 and records whatever I need emailed, and then she emails it for me.
Now, does she compress that file when she emails it, or do you know?
It automatically compresses itself. That's one of the things that SoundForge does. It has an automatic level adjustment. She puts it in a, what they call a normalized setting, and it compensates for any. You can't go too much over with that. Too much. The level's got to be reasonably within
10 dB or so, 5 dB.
Uh-huh. But it will make it perfect, and it compresses it, and it takes care of all the level and compression stuff, and then she sends it out.
I made a deal with a little guy down in Livingston today to do production for him, and I'm going to compress it, make an MP3 file out of it at 128 stereo, and mail it to him. I'll never have to leave my house.
Yeah, that's pretty handy. I remember I did my first freelance jobs in South Alabama. I had to mail them to Meridian. Had to be sure to put it in a reel to reel tape box and get it shipped out.
Listen, we've I hate to tell you this, but we've killed an hour. We got about 30 seconds. Give me your website and some way someone could get in touch with you if they wanted to.
You can email me at ken@mightypipes.com. My website is www.mightypipes.com.
MightyPipes.com. And ken@mightypipes.com will get an email to you.
Mm-hmm.
Ken, sir, it's been a pleasure, and I'll be back in touch and let you know when we are ready to air this interview on ACB and Radio Reading Services. Thank you much, and continue. Keep on keeping on.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Ken.